This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We'll call this meeting of House Judiciary to order and ask our secretary to please take the roll.
Representative Ingalls. Representative Feinstein.
Here.
Representative Gibson.
Here.
Representative Gosch.
Here.
Representative Hamel.
Here.
Representative Huffman.
Here.
Representative Killer.
Here.
Representative Lust.
Yes, here.
Representative Mosier.
Here.
Representative Schluckaway.
Here.
Representative Turpeville.
Here.
Representative Hunt.
Here.
Representative Cutler.
Here. We do have a quorum present. Representative Ingalls is excused. Well, good morning once again, and welcome back to House Judiciary. A couple of things. First of all, we'd like to thank our pages for being with us this morning. Did we lose one? If you'd like to stand up and tell us your name and where you're from. Hi, Brittany. Thanks for being with us this morning. And a reminder that anyone testifying on a bill is required to sign in, and our interns and pages can help with that. All cell phones should be off or on vibrate. And I wanted to go through just a few things this morning as we get started for the sake of our new committee members in terms of process in the committee. A reminder that any questions, comments, or motions to be made have to go through the chair, and you have to first be recognized by the chair. And we'll appreciate that. All motions must have a second. There are no prefatory remarks to be made on motions until the motion has been made and seconded. You can make a motion. We can amend that motion. And then you can make a substitute motion to all of that. But that, at that point, it all gets stopped. There's no further action in terms of amendments that can be made. You can, of course, make a substitute motion after a motion to amend has been made as well. Later in the session, we will have, I don't think I've been through a whole session in this committee without seeing a hog house bill. So I'm quite certain that somewhere along the line you will see those. Any bill that is changed substantially will also need a title amendment. And I know there are some of the returning members that can help me as the chair and reminder that if we do substantially change the bill, the title may have to be amended. Let's see. Have I forgotten anything? Anything you'd like to add? We do need approval of the minutes. Moved by Turbeville. Is there a second? Second by Gibson. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? The minutes are approved. That's why we have a good vice chair here. All right. We'll just move to our calendar then this morning. And the first item of business that we have is a presentation by our Chief Justice, Dave Gilbertson, and we invite him to come up along with our Court Administrator, Pat Dugan. And we welcome you to House Judiciary and are happy to have you come up and visit with us for a few minutes this morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, and thank you for the invitation. She mentioned to me when we were visiting casually, there were many new members on this committee, and invited me up simply to explain a little bit about the dynamics between this committee and the judicial system. Before I do that, I'd like to introduce Pat Dugan, who is our new court administrator. She replaced DJ Hansen, who retired a couple of months ago, and she is charged with the responsibility of administrating the judicial system for the entire state because we have a unified judicial system. And you will see her from time to time. She does plan to come up and involve herself somewhat in proposed legislation, although our chief lobbyist is Judith Roberts, who is a staff attorney. One of the things that the Chief Justice is allowed to do, which is maybe unique to South Dakota, is allowed to introduce bills. I don't get to vote, but I can introduce bills. And these are bills that come from the Judicial Conference, which is an organization of all the judges in the state. And if they want a bill proposed, then it comes in to this committee, I think, as a matter of course, as a Chief Justice's bill, G Generally, these bills are of a fairly technical nature. They will deal with court procedure, not major overhauls of statutes, tweaks, if you will. And you'll see some Chief Justice bills this year, and that's what they're doing, is kind of tweaks. It's not a legal term, but it probably best describes it. Another thing that that we do and you do is we both pass laws or rules that affect how the courts are run. Generally, the substantive statutes, penalty bills that define both civil and criminal obligations and duties, come from the legislature. The court, however, under the Constitution, has authority to adopt rules of procedure, in other words, how you run a court system. And so where there is no bright line. And so sometimes those proposals will come to the Supreme Court as a rule proposal, and we'll have a rules hearing in February. And if they're substantive, they'll come through this committee, and if this committee sees fit to pass it, then they go to the floor and over to the Senate and then to the governor. And we've had an excellent working relationship in the past. A couple of times, legislative proposals appeared to us to actually be procedural, and we've respectfully asked that they be submitted to the Supreme Court as a rule proposal, and that has been done. And so we both have duties on that that area. Another thing that you may find of interest is generally we do not take positions as a court system on substantive bills, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that we may be asked as a court to interpret what that statute means as part of a lawsuit, and there's even the possibility at some point that we may be asked to decide whether the statute's constitutional or not. So we generally will stay out of substantive proposals unless they affect how we do our business as a judicial system, and then we would send up probably a Ms. Roberts generally to visit with you about the UJS's position, and that will generally come on bills on how the court system is run. We have a unified system in this state where the Supreme Court is charged with running the entire state judicial system. Every one of you come from a county that's got a county courthouse. We have 64 of those in the state. They're staffed by clerks of court, probation officers, judges, and magistrate judges. And so if it goes to that area, you'll probably hear from us. And so that is kind of just a little brief overview of what we're about downstairs. Everybody knows we decide appeals and cases like that, but we also, I probably spend as much of my time as Chief Justice administrating the court system. And so we work, and I think have worked very well with this committee in the past, and have every confidence that it will continue in the future. So, Madam Chairman, those are my remarks. It was basically just to come up and say hi, but if anybody's got any questions, I do have a few minutes.
Thank you, Chief. If Ms. Dugan would like to say a few words, we invite her to do that too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just take a minute to explain the brochure that I've given to the page to hand out. The other side of the judicial system in the courts is the business end of the courts, which is what I'm responsible for. And we are charged with making sure that the state court system runs within the budget that we're given, within the rules, within the laws. We train the judges and the court staff and the probation officers on what the laws mean and how to interpret them day to day on the front lines. We oversee the budget for the statewide system, parcel that out to the different circuits. We work with all of the staff across the state to try and be as uniform as we can from side to side and top to bottom so that all of the work is done more or less the same everywhere. We do invite you to let us know if you have questions about how we're actually running the business end of the courts. That's why we come up here, so that we can understand the bills and give that message out to the staff at our training events.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the committee for either of these? If not, we thank you for coming up to greet us, and we greet you and welcome you to the committee and look forward to working with you throughout the session. Thank you
very much.
As we move to our calendar, a reminder of our process. We take proponent testimony, then we take opponent testimony. There's a brief rebuttal period allowed if there has been opponent testimony. Then we close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. So just a reminder to hold your questions until we get to the appropriate phase of the hearing where questions are appropriate. After the question phase of the hearing, then we are open to committee discussion or action on the bill that's before us. We always use proper names, as the committee is a formal process as part of the legislature. So even though I may know someone very well outside of this committee hearing, I'll be sure to address them by proper name. And that goes for the discussion amongst ourselves as well. All right, with that, we'll move to the calendar. I did want to just remember to mention one other thing. You'll notice Representative Ingalls could not be here with us today. And he did notify me before the hearing that he could not be here. He is therefore excused. And there's a difference, of course, in being excused or being absent from a committee hearing. So I thank him for that, and we'll look forward to seeing him back on Wednesday. All right, with that, we'll move in our calendar to our first bill up. That is House Bill 1015. House Bill 1015 is an act to revise certain provisions regarding inmate appeal of prison disciplinary actions. With that, we are open to proponent testimony for House Bill 1015. And we welcome Ms. Filer back. I think we need your mic on. It looks like it's on because that green button.
There we go.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Should I start over?
Yes, please.
Okay. Good morning, Representative Cutler and members of the committee. I'm Lori Filer with the Department of Corrections. House Bill 1015 is a bill brought at the request of the Department of Corrections, and it deals with really three issues regarding inmate disciplinary matters. When inmates are written up in the penitentiary system, we have a disciplinary process that they go through, including a couple of levels of appeal. And what we are asking to do with House Bill 1015 is to make a few little tweaks, little modifications in some of those things. You'll really see two sets of statutes that look really very much the same if you've read through the bill. And what that is a function of is we have what we call the old system and the new system in South Dakota for parole systems. In 1996, there was quite a big rewrite of the parole statutes. And of course, we still have some people under the old system. Anybody who committed their crime before 1996 is under the old system. So in several instances in our state law, you'll see statutes that are what I call parallel statutes, that they apply. Like the 2415A is the new parole system chapter. So that's always kind of the tag that's the new parole. And then the ones under 2415 or 2413 are typically under the old system. So that's why you see what appears to be duplicate statutes. The three things that this bill does is, first of all, it makes it clear that an inmate, in addition to appealing the fact that they actually committed the prohibited act, they can also appeal the sanction. So if I'm an inmate and I'm written up for something and my sanction is, let's say, a fine of $10, and I think that that's too harsh for what the offense was, I can appeal that and the warden would be able to reduce that sanction. So it's making it clear that it's not just the appealing that you did the prohibited acts, you can also appeal the sanction that's imposed. The second thing that this bill attempts to clarify is that when there is a successful appeal of a disciplinary infraction, that we don't have to wipe all record of that off the inmate's record. We want to be able to make a notation that they were found that they did not commit that, so it doesn't count against them for parole purposes. But we need to have some record that occurred just for an audit trail. You know, if we go back a year or two later and we say, why was that person classified that way? They shouldn't have been, that's an error. We have to know that there was a disciplinary infraction on the record at that time. So it's just clarifying that. And then the final issue is this, that sometimes it happens that an inmate will appeal and the warden will look at it and they'll go, yeah, they did do a rule infraction, but it's not really that serious. And the example that I give, and not to say that either one of these things aren't serious in prison, but if I'm written up for an assault, that's quite serious. If we investigate it, you know, the inmate goes to the court system, they said, yep, it was an assault. The inmate appeals, it's looked at a little bit, And the warden says, you know, it looks like it was more kind of a two-way thing. It was a fight, or there wasn't really an aggressor and a victim. It was more of a fight. That could be then reduced, that the actual infraction could be reduced in addition to the sanction. So those are really the three things that we're attempting to kind of tweak in this bill.
Thank you. Other proponent testimony for House Bill 1015? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1015? If not, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony. Seeing no opponents, I don't think Ms. Beiler needs rebuttal. And so we will close to that portion of the hearing and open to questions of the committee. Other questions of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
I have a question for Ms. Beiler. There are two references in the existing law, and I realize this wasn't part of the amendments that you're making at this time, but there are two references to 30 days, one on line 12, I think, on the first page, and one on line 5 on the second page, in essence. As an attorney, I'm always interested when my 30 days begin, or my 20 day, or when my period begins, in the sense of being able to make sure it's clearly understood by all the parties involved. What's the time frame? When does the 30 days begin in which the challenge can be initiated?
Ms. Beiler.
Thank you. The prison disciplinary process is just that. It's a process. There's several steps with it. And one of the steps is that it's called the Unit Disciplinary Committee, which is more of an informal process. You know, if the inmate says, yeah, I did it, and I'll take my sanction, they can pretty much say that. And if they say, yeah, I did it, I will take my sanction, that's when the 30 days starts. Now, that becomes a bit of a moot point, because by policy we say if you plead guilty, you can't appeal the fact that you did the offense. So typically how it plays out is it's in those cases where the inmates say, no, I didn't do it, or I don't want to take the sanction that you're proposing. They go on to a disciplinary committee outside of the unit. And at that time, if that disciplinary committee says, yes, we are going to find that you committed that, it's the date that they found that they committed the prohibited act. And they are served paperwork that says this is what our finding is.
Madam Chair, just to
follow up, Representative Hunt.
So the 30 days begins when the disciplinary committee of the other unit or whatever announces. Now, is the inmate present when that happens? In other words, is there a 2, 3, or 4 day delay before they get a piece of paper or before they're informed? Does it cut into that 30 days? Are we really talking 30 days? If you could just comment.
The inmate is almost always present. The only time the inmate wouldn't be present is if they were unable to, if they were a super high security risk and actively acting out, then we wouldn't actually bring them to the disciplinary committee, but they would be served the paperwork the same day.
Thank you. Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Further questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Feiler, I just want to follow up a little bit on the process. Is there a hearing for the inmate?
Yes.
When does that occur?
Time-wise?
Where in the process does that occur?
I'm not sure if this, I hope this answers your question. They are served the write-up, and then they go to the unit disciplinary review, and they can either dispense with it then, or if they can't dispense with it then, the inmate doesn't want to agree that, yes, they committed and accept the sanction, then they go on to the disciplinary hearing officer. The time frames, I'd have to dig into my policy to tell you what the time frames are on that. Thank you.
Follow up,
Representative Lust.
In this process and procedure where the warden is notified of essentially an appeal of the infraction, is there a hearing that where the inmate gets to present his rationale for the appeal essentially to the warden?
Okay.
Ms. Beiler.
Thank you. That's a paperwork process under our administrative remedy process. There where the inmate files a written appeal that's submitted to the warden. And then the warden investigates that, submits an answer back to the inmate, and if the inmate is still not satisfied in certain matters, that can then be appealed on up to the Secretary of Corrections as well.
Other questions of the committee? there are no further questions of the committee, we'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1015. Representative Gosch.
Move do pass House Bill 1015.
Move do pass by Gosch. Is there a second? Second by Representative Gibson. Remarks, Representative Gosch. Thank you. Any further committee discussion on House Bill 1015? If not, we'll proceed to the do pass motion on House Bill 1015. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed, no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Feinstein?
Aye.
Representative Gibson?
Aye.
Representative Gosch?
Aye.
Representative Hamill?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Killer?
Aye.
Representative Lust?
Aye.
Representative Mosier?
Aye.
Representative Shekloy?
Aye.
Representative Turville?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Cutler?
Aye.
12 yeas, 1 excused.
And House Bill 1015 goes to the floor. Do pass. Representative Shekloy, would you please be responsible for this bill in informing the caucus and on the floor? And Representative Gibson, would you please carry that to your caucus in explanation?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. Moving the calendar then to House Bill 1016. House Bill 1016, an act to revise the applicability of the rules of evidence to proceedings before the Board of Pardons and Paroles. With that, we are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1016. Good morning and welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you.
I don't believe it is.
Now.
Now.
Good.
Thank you.
My name is Max Gores. Excuse me. I work with the Department of Corrections as a staff attorney, and I'm also an assistant attorney general for the purpose of appearing for the department in court. And I am bringing this legislation to you because I think that it needs clarification. I'll give you a little bit of background. What this does is say that the rules of evidence don't apply to parole hearings. And we never thought it did, but there are some things that have raised questions about that. This bill is patterned after an existing statute, 19914, which says the same thing for the courts for the sentencing and granting or revoking probation. Probation and parole have been determined to be the same thing for the purpose of due process to the persons on probation or parole by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I can give you the citation to that case. And the Supreme Court has also said you don't have a constitutional right to parole. But what they did say in a famous case back in 1972, probably the leading case in the country on due process, they said, once you get probation or parole, you really don't want to go back to the penitentiary. So you have an interest in being out, and they call that a liberty interest, so you're entitled to due process at that time. And they went on to spell out a little bit about it and said, now, the due process that you get at a revocation hearing isn't the same that you would get in a criminal trial. Because in a criminal trial, you're presumed to be innocent. You haven't been found guilty yet. But in a revocation hearing, you've already been found guilty of the principal offense. And now the question is, are you going to get to stay out or not? And so due process is sort of a continuum. You have more due process rights at the are you guilty stage than you have at do you get your probation or parole revoked stage. And the same thing is true with other things. So due process isn't an absolute at any point. It depends on how important your interest is. Now, for years before that, probation and parole were considered to be matters of grace, and they could basically just reach out and pluck you off the street and say, you're going back to prison. But Morrissey changed that. And I want to say something back when I was just out of law school, and a green as grass assistant attorney general in the state of Iowa. I worked on Morrissey versus Brewer, which Iowa lost. I was there in 1970 and 1971, and it was on its way up. But I don't disagree with the ruling that came down. Now, Morrissey said, and I'll quote, "We emphasize that there is no thought to equate this parole revocation hearing to a criminal prosecution in any sense. It is a narrow inquiry. The process should be flexible enough to consider evidence, including letters, affidavits, and other material that would not be admissible at a criminal trial." And our state Supreme Court has quoted this language on several occasions. And, of course, in a probation revocation before the court, there are no rules of evidence. And again, in Gagnon versus Scarpelli, the Supreme Court said, due process is not so rigid as to require that significant interests in informality, flexibility, and economy must always be sacrificed. And again, that's been quoted as recently as 2006 by our court. And for years, we always thought hearsay and other things were admissible in parole hearings. Back in 2000, the Supreme Court, in a case called Burgee versus the Board of Pardons and Paroles, said, and I quote, "The rules of evidence are inapplicable." But in 2004, in a case that didn't involve paroles or probation, the Supreme Court in Dubray versus the Department of Social Services said something different. They said the rules of evidence do apply in administrative hearings. There it was a question of social services, not of probation or parole. The use of hearsay evidence and other evidence that wouldn't be admissible in a criminal case or under the rules of evidence fits revocation hearings and other parole hearings because the state often puts in documents from the parole file and from police reports and from affidavits and statements of witnesses, or perhaps as the police officer that investigated the violation testify as to what the findings of the investigation were. So the police officer probably will say what someone else said. Hearsay. The inmates also use hearsay in their defense all the time because they don't always have witnesses to come, or if they do come, they still have witnesses who use hearsay as well. And so the hearsay rule cuts both ways. If the inmates can't use hearsay, there wouldn't be much they'd be able to say at a lot of these hearings. Let me give you a couple of examples. If the inmate says, well, so-and-so said I could have a job when I got out, that's hearsay. I could object to that. I don't, because I think it's admissible, and I think it's important for the board to know. If the inmate says, I've got treatment lined up at thus and such a place, they told me I could get in next month if I get out, that's hearsay, and it would not be admissible. So it isn't just the state that has an interest in relaxed rules of evidence. Now, the important thing here, South Dakota has dramatically increased the number of people on parole over the years. First of all, the population has gone up in the institution. I started my first time with the parole board in 1973. I was on the parole board. Kind of young for that, but I still was. And at that time, there were about 300 inmates in the men's prison in Sioux Falls. There are now about 3,500 inmates in the whole prison system, men and women. So you see there's a huge increase in inmates. And of course we had a commensurate number of people on parole, 300 or 400. Now on a given day, there are between 2,300 and 2,400 inmates on parole in South Dakota and another 500 on parole out of state, so almost 3,000. Now, it's important when you put somebody out on parole, when you take a chance on them, that if they don't do it right, that you can get them back in. Because one of the interesting things is that people tend to have a reoffense cycle. You don't start out being a bad parole violator. You probably have a drink or two or stay out too late or miss work or something, and it builds up. And so if you catch these people that are violating early, you can do something about it. And we don't revoke everybody that does something wrong. We have a very carefully crafted policy, and we do what are called policy-driven responses. If they catch you drinking, they're going to give you a sanction without bringing you back in. If they catch you drinking again, the agent might put you in jail over the weekend, and then you're back out. If they catch you the third time, you're probably going to go see the board on a revocation. And so we're trying to keep people out, but we have to be able to put them back in if they're not cooperating. The United States Supreme Court recognized this problem just a couple of years ago in 2006 in a famous case, Sampson, S-A-M-S-O-N versus California. They said that parolees could be searched without a warrant and without any reason. If you're the agent and you think that you ought to search John Doe who's on parole, you can just do it. Because it's important to be able to use those surprise searches to see if there's anything inappropriate. Random urinalysis, random drug tests, and so forth are the same thing. And the court noted specifically, it said that parolees are more likely to commit crimes than other people. And so they said the state has an overwhelming interest in making sure that parolees are following the law and the rules, and therefore they don't get as much constitutional protection as you and I would. I'm sorry, they can't just walk up and say, okay, you have to take a drug test, you see, because they have to have some kind of probable cause or a warrant, or we have to be under arrest. So we're suggesting that we fix this by changing the statute to exactly the same thing that the Supreme Court has in their rules for probation revocations. We have an administrative rule that says exactly this. It says what Morrissey said: evidence at the final hearing may include testimony, affidavits, letters, and other material not admissible in a criminal proceeding. But I think we need a statute, because the Supreme Court said that the statutory rules of evidence apply. So that's what we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gores. Other proponent testimony for House Bill 1016? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1016? If not, we will close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Hamill.
Just a question about what problems have been created by the current statute. You want to fix the statute, but can you give me a little idea what an example or two of the problems that have been created by the existing statute?
Sure. I had an inmate at a hearing. This was a the equivalent of a revocation hearing. It was a non-compliance hearing, who is a sex offender. And he said, no, I'm not a sex offender. I never did any of those things. And we had evidence and reports going back to 1961 when he was in the army in Germany. We had German police reports, army police reports, but let me tell you, I could not find those witnesses, either who he had abused or who had made the reports. But I was able to put, and the board accepted them. But I think if he had appealed, perhaps it might have been reversed, you see. And there are other examples like that. We get situations, we hold all the hearings in Sioux Falls at the penitentiary. But the violations occur in places like Rapid City, Aberdeen, and so forth. And we often have people testify by telephone because it's difficult to bring a whole room full of witnesses all the way from Rapid City to Sioux Falls. And the police officer will testify as to what he saw and what he heard when he was investigating the crime. Those kinds of things happen all the time.
Other questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gores, I have a concern that maybe you can help me overcome. I understand your the necessity to maybe not have the hearsay or the witnesses authentication of documents, so on and so forth. I'm troubled about the privileges. If we get rid of the chapters or make the chapters you're asking be removed, you would also be removing, it appears, all privileges, attorney-client, clergy, clergy privilege, interspousal privilege. And I'm concerned that that might go a bit too far. How can you help me get over that?
It isn't our intention to abrogate those privileges. We just copied what the Supreme Court has for probation revocations. Now, as a former circuit judge, I can tell you I never let anybody violate the attorney-client privilege at a probation revocation hearing. Now, that doesn't answer your questions, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm worried mostly about hearsay, things like the best evidence rule, because we put in copies of things that, you know, we can't get the original of a police report. The police keep that. We want to be able to put copies in and so forth. I would have no problem with dropping the privileges out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions of the committee? Representative Feinstein.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just have a question. A reference to this bill was to 2413.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the last sentence of 2413.6, and doesn't that take care of it? That says, you know, that section is about clemency and parole hearings and that, and it says neither this section nor its applications may be the basis for establishing a constitutionally protected liberty, property, or due process interest in any prisoner. Is that already covered?
No, and I'll tell you why it isn't. There are more than one kind of parole hearings. You have the granting of parole, and you have the revocation of parole. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that at the granting of parole, you don't have any constitutional right to get one. But at the revocation, since you've been out on it, you have a liberty interest in staying out. And therefore, you do have a right to due process. Essentially, you don't have a right to due process at the granting stage, but you do at the revocation stage. Now, I wanted to make it clear that hearsay, the rules of evidence don't apply to either one, but they obviously don't now apply to the granting stage.
Other questions of the committee? Thank you. If there are no further questions of the committee, we will close to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1016.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lust.
I have an amendment.
Please state your amendment.
I would amend line 6 of the bill to change the numbering in the chapters that are being addressed here. And the amendment would state the provisions of chapters 9 would be 19, 9 through 12, and 19.14 through 18.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Feinstein. Representative Lust, remarks on that motion.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Chapter 19-13 addresses privilege, and I think I don't think the proponents of this bill intended to waive the attorney-client privilege, the clergy privilege, interspousal privilege, things of that nature. I don't think they would have any application in a revocation hearing or a parole hearing. So I would ask that that chapter be stricken and probably the original purpose and the understanding of the proponents is not affected by that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the Lust motion to amend? Seeing none, this is a voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? That motion carries. We are back to House Bill 1016 as amended. Further action on House Bill 1016. Representative Lust.
I move to pass.
Move to pass. Is there a second? Second by Feinstein. Remarks on the motion to do pass House Bill 1016 as amended, Representative Lust. No further remarks. Is there any other further committee discussion? Seeing none, we will proceed to the vote on the do pass as amended motion on House Bill 1016. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Feinstein?
Aye.
Representative Gibson?
Aye.
Representative Gosch?
Aye.
Representative Hamill?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Killer?
Aye.
Representative Lust?
Aye.
Representative Mosher?
Aye.
Representative Schleckaway?
Aye.
Representative Turboville?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Culler?
Aye.
12 yeas, 1 excused.
And House Bill 1016 will go to the floor. Do pass as amended. Representative Hamill, will you please carry this bill to the caucus and be responsible for it on the floor? And Representative Feinstein, would you please be responsible for it in your caucus? Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last bill today is House Bill 1017. House Bill 1017, an act entitled an act to revise certain provisions regarding the escape from a non-secure facility. We are open to proponent testimony on House Bill 1017.
Representative Cutler, members of the committee, Lori Filer with the Department of Corrections. 1017 is another Department of Corrections agency bill, and this deals with some provisions of escape from a non-secure facility. Those of you that have been in the legislature for a few years probably remember the criminal code revision in 2005. Prior to 2005, the escape statute, there was just one degree of escape. And it was, I believe, a class 4 felony, which carries a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. Through the work of the Criminal Code Commission, there was a distinction made recognizing that there's really different types of escape. If a person escapes from the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls, you know, tunnels under the wall or goes over the wall or something like that, that's a real different type of conduct than somebody who is released from a correctional facility to go out into the community and work as a community service worker or on a furlough or work release. And so there was a distinction made in 2005 to make two levels of escape, a first degree escape, which remained the class 4 felony and was defined as escape from physical confinement in part. And then the second degree escape was reduced to a class 5 felony, which is a maximum penalty of 5 years in state prison for that offense. And that was defined as somebody who fails to return following an assignment. And the criminal code, I remember reviewing these proposed revisions at the time and working on language with LRC staff and some of the legislators. And what we missed when we were reviewing that is the notion that we have people who are at non-secure facilities. They haven't been let out of them, but they're at a non-secure facility and they leave without authorization. You know, we've got what we call trustee units is kind of the common term. We've got trustee units in Yankton and Sioux Falls and a small one in Rapid City. If we have a person who leaves without authorization from one of those units, we think that's a second degree escape, that's more comparable to somebody who's been let out of that facility and fails to come back, as opposed to a class one escape. And so that's what this bill is in part trying to address. There are also very occasionally issues when we have a youth that's in DOC placement who will escape from one of those placements and law enforcement is called and a decision is made to prosecute. Now, I will tell you, most of the time when a kid is in DOC placement and they escape, it is handled very informally, because usually what it is it's a meltdown, it's an overreaction, you know, something has come up where they're not handling it well, and they take off running. And usually what will happen is our staff will go get them, try to debrief, get them back under control, and get them back in the program. We don't have any interest, nor do we want to charge kids like that with escape. That doesn't accomplish anything. About the only time kids are charged with escape is if there's other victims. You know, they get away from us and they're gone a long time, they steal a vehicle, they break into a house, those sorts of things. In those cases, local law enforcement is obviously involved and a decision may be made to charge with escape. We have many, many kids in private placement in South Dakota, including many placements where they access the community. It's like a trustee unit, probably even more relaxed than a trustee unit. If a youth escapes from one of those places and there are additional victims and the decision is made that they want to prosecute, we wanted that clear that that should be a second degree escape. And so we've also included that. You'll see the term placement in the bill, and that's what that's referencing. So with that, I'll try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Filer. Is there any other proponent testimony for House Bill 1017? If not, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1017? Seeing none, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Lust.
Want to miss an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Filer, I have a question.
On page 2, the last second line 15, just out of curiosity, it looks like the amendment adds or leaves a non-secure correctional facility without authorization. If a prisoner fled a non-secure correctional facility due to an emergency, fire, tornado, something like that, in your mind, would that be a grounds for, would that be authorized or unauthorized?
If there was an emergency, that would be authorized. I mean, it would be like a evacuation. That would be authorized.
They don't need to wait for consent to do that? Okay, thank you.
Other questions of the committee? Not, we will close to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1017. Representative Turpeville.
Thank you. I would move to approve.
Do pass by Turpeville, seconded by Hamill. Remarks, Representative Turpeville.
I have nothing further.
Further discussion by the committee? Seeing none, we'll proceed to the vote. The do pass motion on House Bill 1017. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Feinstein.
Aye.
Representative Gibson.
Aye.
Representative Gosch.
Aye.
Representative Hamill.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Aye.
Representative Killer.
Aye.
Representative Lust.
Aye.
Representative Mosier.
Aye.
Representative Schleckaway.
Aye.
Representative Turbeville.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Cutler.
Aye.
12 yeas, 1 excused.
Thank you. And House Bill 1017 goes to the floor. Do pass. Representative Mosier, would you please carry this bill to our caucus and be responsible for it on the floor? And Representative Killer, would you please take this bill to your caucus for explanation? Thank you. With that, committee members, we have concluded our business for this morning, and the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make a motion that we adjourn, Madam Chair.
Moved by Representative Hoffman, seconded by Representative Gibson. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? We are adjourned.